Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. Welcome back to part two of my interview with Dr. Rahayel Draizma. As a reminder, she is the author of two books, Language Signs and Calming Signals of Horses and Scent Work for Horses. I had the good fortune to be able to attend a course with her recently where she discussed both of those topics. She has a significant career working with dogs and horses. From the course, she reminded us multiple times that if we're going to ask dogs and horses to live in a human world, then we can make that experience as comfortable, inviting, and stimulating for them as possible. And so we're going to begin this episode with her transition from using just what would be considered behavioral conditioning training methods. Many listeners who might work with horses are going to recognize those. Mental health professionals might recognize these as the work of Skinner and Pavlov and others. And in part one, I just want to remind you that she mentioned a significant experience she had with one dog who would not come out from underneath its owner's bed. And she highlighted there her insight in that moment that she could try to bring the dog out from underneath the bed by, you know, giving it a steak or some meat or some sort of incentive treat to come out from underneath the bed. And she had the insight in that moment that she would still be doing something to the dog. So even just kind of luring it out with a treat would be something done to the dog. And what she wanted to do and what her work now encompasses are ways where instead of the traditional training methods being done to that dog and now horses, she's developed ways that internally motivate the horse or the dog to want to come out and interact in a human world. And that's what I find so exciting about her work, is it's not just about how to make our relationship with horses and dogs better from our human perspective, but also from our animal friends' perspectives. And so the way this episode leads off is we're talking about those training methods, and then we also refer back to Jaak Panksepp's work. And I want to draw that in as well for listeners who may be familiar with the podcast. I've reviewed Panksepp's work in multiple episodes, which I'll list here in a minute. But Jaak Panksepp and Lucy Bibben wrote a foundational book called The Archaeology of Mind, Neuroevolutionary Origins of Human Emotions. And the reason it's relevant here, and to my view, all work as a mental health professional, is because Panksepp and Bibben are helping tie in our common physiology with animals into the therapy session. And they have an actual introduction in their book that's a whole subsection about why physicians, psychiatrists, psychotherapists like myself would want to understand these systems. And so what they describe is this notion that there's three different processing systems. So they talk about the primary process systems, which are the seven basic affective systems that I'll list here in a minute. But they also remind us that they see things that perhaps those of us as mental health therapists might think we're normally doing in our sessions is working on secondary and tertiary process systems. Secondary being the inbuilt emotional learning mechanisms, and the third order processes being emotional thoughts and deliberations that are evident in human experience. This is from their book that I will list in the show notes. But the primary process systems, they argue, are part of our mammalian brains that we share with all mammals and drive a lot of the second and third order processes. So their premise here is that, you know, we can work with emotions and thoughts, but on many occasions, there's a foundation of the primary systems that are maybe congruent with someone's emotions and thoughts. But in my experience, often we meet our therapy patients because things are incongruent. In other words, their bodies are acting in ways that their thoughts and feelings don't align with. A lot of times I specialize in working with people who've experienced trauma, and it's very common for the trauma responses to get out in front of the mental and emotional responses because trauma responses are in the service of survival. So people's trauma responses actually are quicker than they can kind of emotionally or thoughtfully process how they want to act, behave, say something. So a lot of times people are seeking therapy to help resolve this difference that's really common in all humans. If we're honest, I think all of us experience this. So this is why I like Pink Sump's work so much, is because it really helps us kind of conceptualize and frame, and for me, tie in our work with dogs and horses into this framework, because now there's this sort of common framework that we all share, and we can see it in our horses and dogs. And when in doubt, in an animal-assisted therapy session, we can kind of triangulate what we're seeing in our animal partners to help us better understand what we're seeing in our patients and participants. So we're going to talk specifically about Panksepp's idea of the seeking system. And briefly, they also explain that the seeking system, like Dr. Dreisman is going to explain, there's many neurochemicals happening here. And one of them, though, specifically is dopamine. And Panksepp and Bivens' book discusses that, quote, whenever there is an increased release of dopamine in the brain, animals are more aroused in a distinct type of way. They become more eager and inquisitive. And this happens when animals exhibit these seeking behaviors that they describe in their book. The seeking behaviors are when we can anticipate all kinds of attractive events in the environment. So seeking is the part of the seven basic systems that is associated with the others, because as I understand it, it's kind of like you need your seeking system to be engaged before you can do anything else. And we're also going to talk about fear, but just again, the other systems for your reference are rage, lust, care, panic and grief, and play. Most of those are self-explanatory as to what animals would have as their seven basic systems. At least that's what Panksepp and team have found out. And when we're referring to the affective systems, these are the ones we're talking about. And just in case you're not yet bought into the fact that even if you're working in an office and never plan to work in an animal-assisted therapy environment, let me just remind you that dopamine is another something that we might focus on, because if we consult with our psychiatrist counterparts and others, we're going to be reminded that dopamine, either it's excess or lack of, is implicated in many of the mental health conditions that we are trained to treat. And so what Dr. Dreisman is going to explain here is how she works with horses to increase their dopamine levels. And what I'm hoping we can do is start to consider what in animal assisted therapy sessions, this might similarly or maybe in tandem also affect patients' neurochemicals, and or how we could do something similar in our therapy offices. Of course, we need to practice within our bounds, and not necessarily do we all have the skills to directly impact neurochemicals, but she's going to say something at one point here about how much she's a practical person first, and then she goes diving into the books to help explain what just worked for her in real practice and real life. And I think that we can take that model here and sort of start to see some of our natural instincts come to life in our own sessions. And I'm pleased to present the second part of the interview so that you can hear how it works for her when she works with horses.
I wouldn't call it magic, but it is sometimes almost magic if you see the enormous changes in such a short time. And if, as you say, in a few days from aggression to non-aggression, with the use of scent work, but also with the use of calming signals, the combination. And why don't I call it magic? Because we can explain quite a few things. If I look at scent work, and if I look at the trainings we give, we have obviously desensitization, we have counter conditioning, we have habituation. Obviously, we can work with punishment, negative reinforcement, but I'll concentrate on the positives one, reinforcement, desensitization, and habituation and counter conditioning. If we look at a lot of training methods, they are aimed at, when there is a challenge, at erasing the challenge and giving new feelings or positive feelings with that new behavior they want to implement with horses. And very, very often, and I say very often diplomatically because I get, like, it's a huge percentage of the cases, I find that when I see the trainings, the seeking system or the curiosity of the horses is not stimulated at all. So here we are. We're trying to change emotions like a scared horse or a horse with separation anxiety by doing small steps to have him get used to going away to the other horses. And it takes a long time. And sometimes we hear people say it's easy and quick to change behaviors, but it takes long to change emotions. My experience with the scent work is that you can change emotions in a much quicker way. Why? Because scent work, as you said, involves the seeking system. So with that horse of separation anxiety, to make it like maybe very practical, you can also take small steps. You can also take small steps from that horse away from the herd. However, what I would do is first get seeking system active. First, get a lot of enriched environments, maybe in the green zone, in the zone where the horse feels comfortable. You do scent tracking with him so that the neurochemicals of the seeking system, which I come to a little later, are activated. So you are trying to make new neural pathways in the seeking system. Seeking, curiosity, proactive behavior as a counter to fear. When that is established, then you take your small steps. The horse wants to seek. He knows the seeking exercises. He sees you set up a seeking exercise right outside the pasture, right outside his green zone, and he's almost standing on his toe to get a go. So you can still take the steps, but you do want to involve seeking system. And why do I say first do it in the comfort zone and then take the steps? Because prepare the brain before you train. You want to have some neural pathways intact. And when there's a choice to be made by the organism, do I have to be fearful? Do I need to flee? They choose for proactive curiosity. But they can only do that when there are already new neural pathways in the right system in the brain active. Does that make sense? Okay, neurochemicals then, because I think one of the absolute interesting thing about scent work is that the nose and the olfactory system is the system that has an olfactory tubercle in the brain. And it's a small area, and it is dense with dopamine receptor genes. So if we can stimulate that nose to really inhale and use it, then extra dopamine is secreted in the brain. Now, not to say that there are no other chemicals, I mean, not at all, and the body is absolutely complex and there's more to it, but for the story, I will simplify it. And do know I'm a practical person. I work with horses most of the time. I get my results and then I go and think like, how is this possible? And dive into books. But what I find with that scent work, that if I am asked to help a horse that shows many, many opportunities or many cases or many times of shutdown for a longer period, or I help a horse that has chronic pain issues, so also shows signs of shutdown, we know that these horses have a low dopamine level. They don't take initiative. They stand, their features are flat, not curious, not responding well. So if I get that seeking system up and they are invited to start seeking and they take the first steps and the first steps are repeated and the body gets to get a feel of that seeking system, I am purposely, with the exercise, stimulate the body to secrete extra dopamine. And the low dopamine level that horse has gets an extra push up. So that extra push up makes that horse, if I compare it to the horses that don't do scent work, the horse that does that scent work is more quickly awake, more quickly responsive to the owner, more quickly looking at what's happening around him, easier to touch, easier if you do a step back that he will follow. So there is an awakeness to that horse more quickly. If we talk about another challenge we have with horses, that might be the horse that is severely stressed. So maybe he just moved, or there is a competition, or there's something in the environment that spooks him. So it might be a very high chronic stress level, or it might be that that horse has multiple moments of tension and he spooks, well, twice a day or once a day, and there's not really a good recovery, not to comfort zone. So that horse also has tension. What we know from those horses is that they have low dopamine levels, but also, and I only mentioned one stress hormone for the simplicity of the story, but do know there are more, but he also has high glucocorticoid, and cortisol is one of them. So doing scent work with that horse, and again, the scent work where he intensely uses the nose, so not looking at something or figuring out where something is, but you see the nose at work, then with that horse, the low dopamine levels goes up, but there's a very neat thing in the body. If dopamine is secreted, cortisol cannot. It's almost like a seesaw relationship. So cortisol goes down. So if you do scent work sessions with that horse, and it might be the easier one every day, like a treat search, but the scent tracking maybe twice a week, and the more intense exercise, what you see is that horse has less tension because cortisol is not secreted and the dopamine lingers in the body. It's not only the scent exercise, but it lingers longer in the body and his low dopamine levels go up. So that horse also more quickly than a horse that doesn't do scent work goes into the homeostasis line, where that horse is a bit more awake, but because he's not as stressed, he is calmer. So he gets a demeanor that is much nicer for us to work with, calmer, more attentive. And I think the other definite advantage I need to tell people about with the scent work, and that can be a treat search where you scatter food. And again, it's not scattering food like here's your feed bowl and a scatter at the front of your face. That's just eating from the floor. That's completely different. It is one arena with five treats in it. So they can search for 5 to 15 minutes to five treats. So they use the nose. And what a big benefit is for that is that the horse feels, how can I move in relaxation? Because when they do scent work, their nose is a bit tilted to the ground. Their body is almost, well, I don't know how to describe it, Brenda, but it is like, I'm making the gesture now, but you cannot see it, but it's almost like rounded, where the nose is to the ground, and how would we describe it like that?
It's almost, to
Arched.
me, yeah, arched.
It's almost arch. And if you stretch that top line to get the nose on the floor, you have to relax your muscles. You have everything, the fascia, the top line, everything should be relaxed. Otherwise, you cannot do it. If you're too stressed, you cannot find the treats. If you're too tired, you cannot find the treat. So the organism, by doing so, finds the most relaxed but still active posture to keep moving. And that is something many horses can use, because many of our horses move, and when there's a trigger, there's flight system active. And in their body, they did not have yet the experience that you can also move with relaxation.
Yeah.
Yeah, apart from all the other things we said neurochemically, but this, I hope this makes sense to the listeners.
Very much. It does.
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. And so you're showing us some of the ways we see if a horse is operating from that seeking system, is how their body looks and the arch, like we're talking about, and the muscles kind of soft. So moving back to calming signals a bit. And because I know we assess their use of calming signals in relationship to what we see on their face, for example. Can you describe some of the ways that we could see their eyes, their mouth, their nose operating either from the fear system or the seeking system so that we can, in addition to their body signals, start to see in their face when they're shifting back and forth between these two?
Yes. Overall, I think if we talk about seeking system, there are proactive behavior towards a stimulus. Because you seek, you're curious, you wonder, what is it? Can I get something? And I want to have it. So it is always towards a stimulus, while fear system is going away from a stimulus. Seeking system, you have your eyes open, your nostrils open, the eyes show interest. You can see the color of the eyes. Very often you see a shimmer of light in the eyes, because it's not half closed, the eyes, it's not widened, it's not in fear system that they widen the eye. It's almond shaped. Wait, very often in seeking system, not when there's ambivalent behavior, but if it's solely seeking system is on the direction they want to go, on the going forward, still they can push themselves from behind, but it's not like that they are moving away from it and leaning on the outer side, on the other side of where the stimulus is. Tail with fear system might be clenched, or it might be a little bit up, more upwards. Although also with seeking system, you don't see the clenched tail. So the clenched tail, I would say, is with fear. But the elevated tail, not extremely high, you don't see that with seeking, but a little light carriage of the tail you might see with both. Overall, as you say, with seeking system, soft muscles, very soft. And we saw just an in between. We saw Sophie the last days, and what we saw with treat search for the last days, that she really had a hard time bending to the right when getting treats. And I mean, she's not on a lead rope, she's not on a halter, so it's all free movement. And this morning we had treat searches with her, and she did beautiful smaller circles. So the relaxation and the softness of the muscles after a few days enabled her
Wow.
to do that movement. Yeah, so that was
That's great.
really, really nice to see. Yeah. So the muscle is different. Well, with flight system, you see the high head, you see the tense muscle, you see a shorter top line. In the mouth, what you may see, and that's a little bit, well, is it tricky in a way? What you will see in the mouth when the fear system might be active is might be parallel lips. So the bottom lip does not protrude the upper lip. And you see parallel lips, so they're a little bit tight, or they are clenched. You might see more wrinkles around the mouth seam. Sometimes you also see a lengthened mouth seam with a fear system being active. Not with all horses, but some you do. That clenched lips, I don't see with scent work. It might be that a horse is ambivalent and that you see parallel lips. You might also see maybe a lengthened upper lip, but it's not the lengthened upper lip for tension, but it might be the lengthened upper lip to grab something, or a little lengthened. But the mouth that changes in flight system when there's high tension, then you might see a very lengthened upper lip with a round tip, or you might see concave nose or pointy nose. So that you would not see in seeking system. It's too relaxed. What might also be different in seeking system, you have horses that blow out their nose, but softly, so to get the mucus out, and then they can smell better. While horses in flight system, if it's a more severe flight system and the body is tense, if they would snort, it would be the shorter ones, or like that. So that is like an even harder snort, right? And then the soft blowing out. So that's the difference. Let's see. Ears, when they do seeking system, ears are forward on the thing they are seeking. So either forward or when they hear something in the environment, they will turn with the ear towards the environment. But with flight system, very often more activity in the ears because they want to check the surrounding and also check the stimulus they're afraid of.
Yeah, I wanted just to have people get a sense of how in detail you observe the horses. It's really, and what we learned in the course is it's context dependent to that horse and what that horse is capable of. And observation skills are really incredible.
Oh, thank you so much. Because I was going to say we didn't take the muscles yet, and we didn't take the concaves and the lines. So many things we did not even include. True. But it is, I have to say, I think it is an ability everyone can learn. And you get better the more you do it. So don't think you need to have already a special eye. Start practicing. And you will see more and more and more. Start filming and analyze films. Stop them every minute or every few seconds. Not every minute, every few seconds. And have a look what is changing. And then go back in real life again. Because real life obviously is more challenging because it goes quick. But the films help you to practice.
Yeah. For reference, I mentioned Jaak Panksepp's work in episodes 11, 15, 16, 30, 32, 38, and 47. I'm quite a fan of this topic, and so I have covered it quite a bit on the podcast. I'm also really impressed with Dr. Dreyzma, and I just want to highlight something she says in this episode, again, to remind us of what she's really doing here. She wanted to find ways to mentally stimulate dogs and now horses such that their interactions with humans would be internally motivating. And I quote, she believes curiosity and courageousness is a counter to fear. And she wants to train not with fear, but see if she can stimulate genuine curiosity and train and work with horses from that moment forward. And so she learned about these calming signals because she needed a way to discern if the horse or the dog at first was in a mode of genuine curiosity. That is to say, if they had moved out of their fear responses and were moving toward a moment of genuine curiosity. So the calming signals that the rubric she has to assess for that is in the service of helping her understand where the dog is or where the horse is in that moment so she can train and work with the animal from that point forward. I think that her work is so fascinating and I look forward to continuing our discussion in the next episode. Thanks a lot. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time. This is so interesting, right? I hope so. I think so. And in case you're in a similar spot to me that you would like to keep learning, I want to let you know that I'm starting a book club about Dr. Draizma's work. It starts in September. We'll be reading her book, Language Signs and Calming Signals of Horses, the one that we talked mostly about in this episode. We'll meet once a month, and then she has agreed also to do a final webinar for us overall, and it'll have a specific section for book club members. So we'll meet in September, October, and November to read her book together, and then she'll join us for a webinar in December. The webinar, as I say, will be widely available, so look for details about that. And if you're interested in joining the book club, there'll be a special part of the time with her that's just for book club members. If you'd like to learn more about her work with me, I hope you'll consider joining this book club. There's a link in the show notes with more information, or as always, we have details on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. Thanks.